I can remember certain things from basic school, but I learned real quick what they told me over there. I mean, you just
You internalize. Learn.
You listen real quick, and you watch, and you learn real quick from somebody else. And you know, and the guys that were there, they told you, you know, there was no problem in not telling you.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to be an ass not tell you,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you were a rookie or you were green or something. Yeah, you were a Marine. At least, I don't know what the Army did, but you were a Marine, and they, you know, they were going to help each other. You came in, they didn't want you to get the guys killed. And they'd ask you, say, have you ever called an artillery fire? No, I haven't. Well, let me show why it works.
Okay.
And you got any more questions? Let's go through it again. And that's the way it worked. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't do it, he'd go to CO and say, you know, he can't do it.
Gary, you went to supply school. Is that right?
Yeah.
Where was that?
No, it was at Camp Lejeune North.
How long was that course? How long did it
take? Oh, about 15 weeks.
So you're becoming a logistics officer, logistics mm-hmm. and supply, is that right?
Yeah.
Was what you learned there what you needed to know?
In my 3 years, I never was in supply.
Not even at the end of your...
I was in it. When I came back after Vietnam,
yeah.
I think I spent 3 months in supply.
Okay.
And that was... And I had forgotten everything. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing.
Now, when you were at supply school, of course, you're going forward thinking these are the jobs I'm going to be put to. This is what I'm going to be assigned to. Did you have an affiliation with a unit at that time?
No.
Okay. What happened after you left supply school?
I stayed at Lejeune
uh-huh.
and was assigned to a supply company.
Okay.
And I did nothing for about 4 months but sit in a chair. I mean, nothing. And I kept wanting them to do something. They said, well, you're going to have orders to go to Westpac. You know, your orders are coming any day.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we just, you know,
so you just...
it's going to take time to work into this program. And they basically didn't want to waste their time with me working me in there. And so I did nothing.
But
you
know, at this point, I mean,
nothing. For 4 months, I did nothing, and yeah. I could, you know, I go in there, where are my orders? You know, when can I go? You know, send me somewhere. And sure enough, the orders finally came, and I got out of there.
To where?
Head west, but going to west, and it was so funny. Then I went to California. We had a month of judge. What they call jungle training and so forth, and you were given a platoon. I think I was given a company of Marines, and so you took these Marines out and you took them around these trails and taught them what you knew about ambushes, how to deal with an ambush, what you would do during an ambush, and we taught them how to defend a hill when it was being taken, if you were being attacked. Then we learned how to take a hill, and you know, and we teach them how to read a map and how to do squad fire or how to do squad and then fire team attacks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one would cover the other, and then you know, and then you teach the other one how to, you know, how to do it and how to use voice commands and arm commands and,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing.
And how long did this last?
About a month.
Where was it? 29 Palms, or where was
no,
it?
No, it was camp. It was camp Pendleton.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think what all happened there that was strange. There was one thing I'll always remember, that there was a lieutenant, and he was a naval graduate, and I guess he was a picture book trying to be Chesty Puller. You know, Chesty Puller.
Yes, sir.
You know, he always had this sawed-off cigar in his mouth, and he was always talking out that side of the cigar, and it was loud, you know. And everybody just got sick of him, you know, and just nobody wanted to be around him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day, He had his platoon up on the side of this hill, and we were, our platoon, we were breaking off and going somewhere. And so my platoon broke off, and we were passing in front of his platoon. And he said something to one of my guys, you know, which is, you're not supposed to do. You got to see something, he, you know, they're out of line or something.
Mm-hmm.
He's come to me, you know. And that, of course, that embarrassed me because I couldn't say anything back to him. It wasn't right, you know.
Right. So he got a dig in.
Yeah, he was just being a big man with a cigar.
Mm-hmm.
I remember looking up at him. He had his hands on the side, and his legs spread. I mean, he was, you know, I don't know, 129 pounds, and he was considerably bigger than me. And so I said, I want to talk to you. When I came back, I'm going to talk to you over here. So he was in front of me. We went behind these trees, and just when I got to these trees, I took my helmet off, and I hit the top of his helmet real hard. Got his he turned around, and I think it scared him or got his attention. And I told him, you know, don't you ever do this again. If you do, I'm going to see you. And I said, everybody in this platoon knows what you're doing. And we just talked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you're forgetting all the points of leadership, you know. If you don't, we can settle it right now, you know. But, so anyway, he didn't stop. He didn't bother me anymore. And one day, he finally got his comings to him. He got relieved. I remember this. He finally got his in the chow hall or out in the field or anywhere. When the chow serve, your men get served first, and then the NCOs get fed. And then your officers get fed.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
And he get broke in line and got fed. Got his chow.
You're kidding.
Yeah, he did. And with
oh,
his cigar. And somebody reported him to the CO.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody at that. And then I went in there with the guy. And I said, I want to tell you something else, what he did to my platoon, you know. And
do you remember what it was he said? Is it something you can tell on the tape or not?
To my man?
Yeah.
It's just something about the way he was marching, you know.
Like implying that he what?
He wasn't marching right, or he didn't have his cover on straight, or you're marching out of tune, or, you know, get squared away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just something that had to do with the way he was marching.
Mm-hmm.
And get that collar up or, you know, your shoes untied or something. But he did it in front of all the Marines. And every Marine knows that you don't bother the other company or the platoon.
Right.
And so.
Right, you mind your own house and that.
Anyway, he got relieved. You know, he got relieved. He got pulled out. I don't know what happened to him after that.
Well, that sounds like it was probably a good decision by someone.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he got, I'm sure somebody got a hold of him, you know, yanked that cigar in his mouth and, You know, you might be from the Naval Academy, but, you know, you're no Chesty Fuller. So, in fact, when he went to Vietnam, if he had some of those Chesty Fullers, these hard chargers, I was told that when they had these guys, I don't know who told me that. I just remember this, that, you know, hey, we're going to high diddle-diddle right up the middle, you know, hard chargers.
Yes.
Just give me a rifle, give me a platoon, and show them where they are. They would take those guys from the field and fly them into Da Nang and take them to the morgue.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd walk through the morgue, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, he wasn't any more high diddle little up the middle, you know? And got kind of sobered them up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no more high diddle little up the middle.
Yeah.
And,
That's interesting.
I heard that's what they had done.
That's interesting. Well, let me just stop you for a minute, Gary, in terms of talking about the training and the progression that you were in, to ask what you were thinking about the conflict in Vietnam itself. I mean, what did you understand about why the United States had sent troops in, particularly the Marines?
No question about why the Marines were going. I mean, that's just obvious we were going. And as far as the war is concerned, I feel today the same way I felt then.
Mm-hmm.
We were, had some type of an agreement signed with those people. to protect them or help them in the event that they were attacked from a foreign source. It was no different to me than Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It was another Korea. And that's the way I feel about it today. And people say, "What you know, we shouldn't have got into that." Well, to me, I don't know about the Tonkin Gulf and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we shouldn't have. Maybe that was wrong. But he was looking for an excuse to go in. And that's the way I feel about it. I'll tell you something I've always wondered, if
sure.
I can get off the subject.
Sure, of course.
I think the greatest, if I could change one thing in my life or with someone else,
mm-hmm.
In my life, was the fact that Kennedy would not have been killed because he was the one that was the first one to start sending the Army Special Forces over.
The advisors.
The advisors.
Sure.
He was the first one to put troops in.
Yeah.
And he started it. And then he was killed, and then it went to Johnson, and it got bigger, and everybody hated Johnson. I think primarily because of the fact that he was from Texas and he talked funny. And again, you had the Bostonites who hated Texas, and it became in my feeling that's what became an NL war. I always would like to, if he could have stayed alive, to see what he would have done.
See what Kennedy would have done.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What he would have done, would he have? I don't know what would happen. I really would like to, I'd like to hear what you would think, what would happen. All those anti-war people who were up in the Northeast, his people, what would his people have done if he'd stayed?
Well, do you think that he would have stayed, or do you think, of course, there's a big discussion?
I have no idea. That's why I say I had no idea.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to talk to somebody that could tell me what they thought might what had happened. He was withdrawing.
Yeah, you'll everybody you would talk to on it, you'd probably get a different answer. It's a lot of debate about it. That's for sure.
Yeah,
a lot of debate.
I'd like to talk to somebody from the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
One of his campaign supporters, or what Bobby Kennedy would have done. Well, Bobby Kennedy was going to pull him out, but That was after Johnson was there. What would he have done if he'd stayed in? Because we were already in. Great mystery.
It is a mystery. It's a very interesting question. When did you, Gary, get your orders for going to Vietnam?
'67.
Do you remember when about?
No.
Sometime in '67?
Yeah, because for some reason, this is true. I was in a Jeep in the hills of California, and a guy pulled in and said, "We got sudden orders for you." And I said, "Where?" He said, "You're going to Iwakuni, Japan." What?
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up going to Iwakuni, Japan for 2 months because somebody got relieved of duty. A lieutenant had a job there, and he did something with the money and got in trouble, and they had had another lieutenant coming, but they had somebody fill that hole there for 2 months. And
what was the job? What were you supposed to do?
It was great. It could have been better. Special services. And I mean, tennis, basketball, and all that kind of stuff.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I even had my wife come over for a month.
Now, when did you get married?
We got married.
What were you doing? Were you already in the Marines?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We got married, I think when I came back, after I graduated from basic school.
I see.
And I came back and got married.
Yeah. What was your wife's name?
Linda.
Okay. Was Linda from Texas?
Yeah.
There you go.
She went to TWU, and I was at North Texas, and there we met.
I see. And so you got to have Linda come over to Japan?
Yeah.
Well, that was good.
Yeah.
What were you supposed to do? Kind of make sure that recreation was available to officers?
Well, Japanese really ran the thing, okay?
Okay, sure.
And but they had to have an American officer sign off and everything.
So you were there to sign off?
Yeah.
And that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, and the thing that's interesting is I found out later that the one of the Japanese that was working for what was working for me, somebody, another Japanese, caught him, and for years, he'd been sniffling money off the top.
Uh-oh.
And invested it in land for years and had beaucoup of money that he had. And he went to jail for, you go to jail in Japan, you go to jail for a long time. And meanwhile, guys like us were just signing off on stuff. And I think they eventually eliminated her job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you one thing funny that's happened over there.
Uh-huh.
I was over there for the 4th of July. And they came over to me, and you know, you can get fireworks over there for nothing.
Yes, right.
And so they came and to me and said, well, we're going to have a fireworks display. And he says, well, we can have a 15-minute fireworks display or a 30-minute display, or we can have an hour's worth of display. And I was piddling around with something. And I, you know, it's your decision, what are you doing? And I said, oh, hell, let's get over and have a 15-minute display.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got out there, and I got myself in trouble.
Uh-oh.
Because there's people that didn't get there in time. But
oh.
I tell you what, 15 minutes of a Japanese fireworks display,
mm-hmm.
It was a second coming. I mean, fireworks were everywhere. I mean, it was from horizon to horizon. I mean, it was everywhere. Simple, spectacular fireworks display. I've never seen anything like it. And then it was over. And it was like a war. You know, he just quit. You know, and everybody's just, well, what are they going to do next? You know, and it was over. It was the greatest 15 minutes of fireworks display you've ever seen in your life.
But you got in trouble.
Yeah, but it was over. You know?
Yeah.
But it was, people said that was, you know, wow. But it was over, you know. They shot off everything, you know. And it was horizon to horizon.
It was great if you were there on time.
Yeah, and it, you know, it should have been a 45-minute show where they get a normal fireworks display. But hell, they just lit the candle and, you know, one fuse, and, you know, and it was literally like a war, and then it was over, you know. And you could see. You'd have this stuff drifting down where you were sitting, you know.
Oh, sure. I bet.
that was kind of neat. That was. So anyway, then I got orders to go south, and that's when I went to Da Nang, and I said, when am I going to get to go? When am I going to get to go? And so. I went, oh, Darren was there. Also, I got to, they had a, this is kind of interesting. They had the shows come over, and they would practice here before they would go to Da Nang, USO shows.
They would practice in Japan?
Yeah, and I had Hugh O'Brien brought a show over.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandy Duncan came with him.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a nobody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, we're in the hotel talking and having dinner, and he pointed her out the other end, and you know, and we talked. She was from East Texas. We talked, you know. And then, lo and behold, years later, she becomes somebody.
Very famous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, she lost an eye.
Yes, I remember that, and, yeah. I don't remember the circumstances.
Well,
but
guess who spent all the time up there with her? Hugh O'Brien.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they were very close.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a song and dance routine.
Hmm.
And part of it, and then the night, one night we went into town. I went into town with him, and we had a good time. You know,
mm-hmm.
he was a neat guy,
mm-hmm.
and he bought my wife a dress, and he bought me something on, and he was a pretty neat guy. He had a brother that was killed in Iwo Jima.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
yikes.
But he was he said he was trying to break out the stereotype of he was playing the part of the TV of who was it? Hickok or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to break out of that role. And that's what he was doing over there.
Well, Gary, let me ask you about your arrival in Vietnam. You arrived at Da Nang, is that right?
Yeah, I went to Okinawa. Then it transferred me to Da Nang.
Okay.
And
did you think that you were going to be doing logistics and supply stuff?
Yeah, I didn't. I had no idea what I was going to do, and I kept thinking, maybe they'll send me out, but I wanted to go out, be assigned to a company somewhere out, you know, outside.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could for entries, because those 4 hours, or those 4 months I spent at Camp Lejeune, I didn't want any more of that. You know, I didn't want to be stuck in Da Nang doing nothing.
And did you tell people that? Did you tell?
Yeah, in fact, that's where I ended up. I ended up in Da Nang,
mm-hmm,
with 1st Marine Air Wing, doing something, you know, with the wing, but it was just, you know, there. And I kept, I told my Major Dillo, I said, you know, first opening you come, send me out there, you know. I don't want just to be sitting here. So I sat there about two and a half months, and during that time, he did, I didn't get a little thing. They had, and I didn't like this. This was kind of, I didn't like it. It was kind of somewhat scary.
Mm-hmm.
We had a squad. I had a squad, two squads. And we, at nighttime, we would go out and we would go through these villages. They're outside our compound.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go through those villages, we'd just walk through them. And just like if you were out in the bush, you would walk through these other villages and you'd check them. You know, you'd check underneath, see the pads, and see if there was actually any tunnels in the Da Nang. It could be tunnels in the Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd check them to see if there's any firearms or anything like that, and you'd find them.
So you're looking for caches of supplies?
Yeah, they're there. What I didn't like about that is the afraid that some guy could, you know, would have a punji hole there that you couldn't see. I mean,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, every time you came up on a mat between these things, you were scared. And I was concerned that somebody could just nail you from behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm,
because these things were so close. But I did come back and find one thing. There was a Vietnamese compound next to a Marine compound, and it was just beginning. Tet was just beginning to happen. Tet, you know, that's when they were going to North try to take over the South.
No, Tet 68, right?
Hmm?
Big Tet.
Yeah, Tet was the big one. The 68, mm-hmm, the 68 Tet. But there were a lot of rumblings going on before that.
Yes, yes.
And I came across this compound, one and the other, and they had a big fence. And the Vietnamese had taken the a six by, you know, which is a big truck, and it had railings on each side of the truck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they drove it up next to this fence. Hold on a minute. Took this 2x8, okay,
mm-hmm,
and they ran this thing over the top of the fence, and then on the other side they put a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
So if they started, you know, and they had three 105 pieces there that they were going to use for support to shoot at. So, in other words, they could get shot at right there. They were an artillery piece. If they got any incoming, the first thing they were going to do was run up this ladder, run across this 6x, and hit this board like a diving board,
mm-hmm,
into this American compound.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over and told the CEO, I said, "You got to come see this." You know, and so he looked at that. He first got mad, and then he says, I'm going to do something. So I said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "No, just leave me alone. I'll do something, you know." So the next night, I came by there, and I couldn't see really what he'd done. And so looked, and then I found out what he'd done. He'd taken a saw, and he had, on his side, he'd had one of his Marines cut about halfway across or better on his side of the fence, real close to the fence, all the way across that board. So the first guy that jumped on side of that fence was going straight down.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was going to be the world's shortest dive. And so anyway, that was something I'd never seen. I took a picture of it. Anyway.
Well, Gary, let me ask, just so that people listening will have a sense of the progression of things. You sent along a copy of your DD-214, for which we thank you, and it shows that you were in the Da Nang area from about September 67 through May 68.
Yep.
Does that sound right to you?
Yep.
And were you with the 1st Marine Air Wing that whole time? Or
yep.
You were. And what was your rank at this time?
I went from, let's see. I became a second lieutenant.
Did you get
first lieutenant?
Uh-huh.
And captain.
Did you become a first lieutenant then while you were at Da Nang?
Yeah, and a captain.
And then promoted to captain.
Yes.
And let me ask about the location. You were based in Da Nang, but you did some operations outside, obviously.
Yeah,
outside the city.
Yeah, during the Tet Offensive, I was moved out, and I got Mike McCullum. He's got a map, and I can't remember the hill numbers,
mm-hmm.
but there was a place out behind the what I call the Bob Hope Theater. Boy, up behind there, up on a hill,
mm-hmm.
there were some hills. I think it was two or maybe three that we had, and we built. And it overlooked this huge valley called Happy Valley. And from there, a lot of rockets were shot into Da Nang from time to time.
From the hills overlooking the valley? Those
no, down in the valley.
Oh, from the valley.
In the hills,
uh-huh.
we would view, and from there we would go patrols from there out into the valley. And fortunately, there was not much jungle there. It was just heavy brush, almost kind of like West Texas brush,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but thicker. And so we would patrol out into those areas and, you know, just basically try to keep them getting ambushed and see if we can make them aware that, you know, they couldn't set up something in there.
Now, just to get the geography right, and correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, does Highway 1 go through Happy Valley?
No.
Okay. It does not.
No, I don't think it did. It went beside it.
It
went between Da Nang and Happy Valley.
And so you're up on the ridge lines, essentially, around Happy Valley.
Yeah.
And how many men were you commanding, let's say, as a first lieutenant?
Okay. At that time, I had about 32. And the other platoons had likewise.
Okay. And I mean, your training, of course, had been primarily leading toward logistics, and all of a sudden here you are, in combat, in command. Was this something that you took to right away?
No, but I was, funny to say, as a Marine, you just say, hey, this is what I'm supposed to do. You were all basically...
Mm-hmm.
combat officers, and these guys know that I'm not trained for it. Somebody will be there to give me some guidance. And sure enough, when I was there, they told me what I was to do,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and told me what to be looking for out there. Be looking for the punji holes, what kind of punji holes they'd be looking for,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of trails to be looking at. Obviously, don't walk on any trails. Don't walk the same place twice. Here are your sister platoon. Here are your support elements. If you get to bind, mortars are over here. If we need mortar support, you know, give you radio calls and all the basic stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the first three or four times you went out, you had a gunny go with you who knew the stuff. He was in command.
And the gunny would be somebody with so much in-country experience yeah. that he would help you out.
Right.
Okay.
And so, and then that, and that's what you do. And I did not get a combat medal because, quite frankly, I didn't really. You know, there was guys that spent 6 months out there in that stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I was out there maybe 6 or 8 weeks, and it just didn't seem right to get one. And so I didn't get one. I didn't ask for one. I didn't even put in for one.
I
wasn't going to be that
yeah,
free guy.
Yeah, I'm picking that up. Gary, when you were out there, were there any... days that you particularly remember, either because you located something, or did you have any contact, or because they were boring days.
There was a village we went way out, and we hit into.
Yeah.
And the standard deal was, and the gunny was in charge, and we went to the village, and it was an unknown village, and so surrounded it, and then we came in. And we poked around and checked out the top of the hooches for weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the bayonets, and we checked the floors under the mats to see for holes and catches and so forth. And while we're doing this, we were rounding up all the Vietnamese. And
mm-hmm.
they ran around like chickens, you know, they, you know, cut off, you know, this sort of thing.
The Vietnamese
civilians. There. Walking around with a camera, and there was a guy with a microphone. And
uh-huh.
where they came from, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
They just came from somewhere.
Right.
And so they were there and filming this thing. And they were filming all this stuff. So I didn't pay more attention to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, we found a door in this underneath one of the mats, which meant it was a tunnel.
Right.
Okay, so I made it a VC village. And so what we did, to call in one or two H-46s and put all the Vietnamese aboard and flew back into the dang where the intel people could separate them and find out any of them were Charlies, which they were, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And they took all the rest of them and doctored the vet, you know, the corpsman checked them out, you know, kids and everybody picked
sure.
them up, and then I understand what they did. Then they put them into a new village to save from where they were, from Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And that took care of them. And then, meanwhile, after we blew or somebody would go down and look at. I don't think anybody did. I think we didn't have any tunnel rats with us.
Right. So what'd you do?
We just blew them. We dropped grenades down in there, and then I think we didn't have any satchel charge or anything. We just
you just threw some grenades down there.
We threw some grenades down there and
uh-huh.
got some secondary charges, explosions down there.
Which told you what?
There was stuff down there. You know, there was armament down there.
Uh huh. Ordnance of some
yeah.
kind. Uh huh.
And then we torched the village, and I can remember this cameraman watching us torch the village, and then this guy was talking on this microphone, and then we turned around, and another helo came in, H-46, and we all got on board, and we went back to the hill, and I remember these two guys went with us, and then they got the hill, and they got on a jeep, and they went back into the dang. And I mention that because when I got back home, I saw something very close to this
yeah.
that really, really upset me. And
saw it on TV?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, it was one of those cases with the press in which they didn't tell you the whole story.
Okay,
and,
sure.
Uh-huh. It was, you know, it was one of those things that, you know, just made you furious.
Did you know, Gary, who... Like, who they represented? Was it Associated Press, or was it American TV, or who
no.
was it?
It was, they were Americans.
Uh-huh. Television?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
you have no idea how they just showed up at your operation.
No, I heard them. I was told they were going to be coming up from behind us.
Okay.
They were going to be following behind us. Don't be concerned that they they were going to be going with us, but they're going to be going. They were going to be, but they showed up late, and they were going to go anyway.
I see.
So we showed up, and then they came up behind us, and they introduced themselves to the gunny, and told them okay. So then they started shooting, and
Now, before you, later saw this kind of operation shown on television in the States, while you were actually there, and they were there filming it, did it bother you that they were there? I mean, did you think, they have no business up here doing, or did you think, well, whatever, they're doing their job?
I didn't really think about them because I was watching the gunny and I was trying to learn what we were in. We were possibly in the VC village.
Yes.
And I was scared that somebody's going to pop out and start gunning us down.
And
I was more concerned about afraid that somebody, we were at,
somebody
I was at the ready.
Somebody might pop up from a spider hole or something.
Yeah,
or
somebody come out from somewhere behind or somewhere. And I was walking around looking for stuff, looking for people.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of making sure that we all had the place covered all the way around it. We wouldn't, I was afraid to get ambushed.
About what time of day was this?
It's afternoon, about mid-afternoon.
And you guys had arrived in the village. How did you get there?
Well, we walked in.
You walked in? No.
We were on patrol, and we were told to go out and check out this village.
And did you get any, other than the interrogation effort, which happened back at Da Nang separately, did you get any intel in the village itself? Like, did you find any written materials or documents or anything?
No, what we did find, it's kind of funny, the gunny forgot to tell us to do this, and when they started torching that thing, we started to walk it off, and we heard something go, pew! And he says, everybody get out here fast. And he forgot to tell us if there's ordnance in there, we might get hit.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, we boogied out of that place pretty fast. I remember that. Boy, that rounds went off everywhere and popping off and so forth. And
it's a little frightening.
Yeah, that's kind of stupid. We got to tell us to,
Yeah.
I mean, we hit, laid down and hid behind stuff. And,
now, how did your guys react this is a pretty stressful situation they're in. You don't know what danger you might actually be in, but you have to assume that you are in danger when this is going on. Did your guys react well, and did they hang together?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. Watching these Iraq films, it's just the training. Where the real stress comes in, and we ran this one time, just a few minutes, is where you just, and it was coming in the dark. Things, you got ambushed from the left, and we went in. Everybody broke out of the trail, and it was me and a radio. And you don't know where anybody is. You don't know where they are. It is terrifying. It is terrifying because you don't know what's going on, and it's your job to
get it together
and try to just what I learned from the gunnies you told me is you got to learn to just stay calm and try to figure out as quickly as you can where the fire's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see the fire, and even go back to Iwo Jima anyway, you can't see bullets flying, and they're not going to have necessarily going to have bullets are going to be I can't say the word where you can see them coming
with tracers and stuff.
Yeah, tracers. They're going to be firing tracers where you can see them coming. They don't have smoke. You just had to listen to the sound.
So you just had to go by what you could hear.
What you can hear. And
wow.
Our problem and our training is to go toward that fire.
Go toward it.
Go toward the fire. Move toward the fire. Put all your weaponry toward that fire.
Right. Uh-huh.
And So we did that, and your squad leaders would have radios, too, and then you would find out, try to find out where they are and anybody, what kind of casualties you've got. And then you'd work from there, try to work around if you could, or if you're close enough. Let them do what they can do and let them tell you what they need, you know. You know, I need backup squad out here, but if we can get somebody over to the right, you know, and eliminate the fire, or we need somebody to bring up the S or whatever. And I forgot exactly what we did. I think I just sat there, and I think one squad worked around to the left, and this is important. I think the people who really run the war are the sergeants, staff sergeants.
Why do you say that?
Because they're the guys that move the people and are with the people.
Right.
You know, I can tell them, but I'm not there. They tell them, and they're there. And they're really the ones that are, you know, they're the Marine Corps. They're the Army, you know.
Well, Gary, let me ask you about another group of people. On a night like the one you're describing where you're in contact, what about the corpsmen? What role did they play, and do you remember anything, if anyone that evening got hurt? Can you tell me anything about those guys and how they performed?
We lost two
corpsmen?
No, we lost
two men.
Two men, and there was nothing the corpsmen could do.
They were okay.
Yeah, there was nothing they could do. They were hit instantly from the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And
did the corpsmen obviously corpsmen were called to find, to try to help them? But
there was a thing. But there was a funny thing that happened. I'm going to tell you something else too.
Okay.
Americans have this knack of. I saw some of this on TV, a couple of history things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you interview them or talk to them and they're together and it's hot and there's nothing they can do and they're sitting there, they'll actually have a sense of humor, you know.
Yes.
I mean, they'll
do. Yes, sir, that's true.
They do. Yeah. Yeah, they will. And, in fact, I forgot where I lost my thought. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We went down to creek embankment, and the corpsman was in the water, and he slipped and fell down.
Yep.
And somebody thought he got shot, and so he opened up, and everybody opened up, you know.
Oh.
And it took about 4 or 5 minutes, and two guys went down on top of him to make sure he didn't get hit. You know.
They threw themselves on top of him.
Yeah, you know, and he's sitting there screaming, and we think he's hurt. And all he's screaming is, get off of me.
Right. But those guys were trying to protect him.
Yeah, and they're trying to protect him. And we're all, you know, finally stopped everybody shooting, you know. And when we stopped shooting, he was screaming obscenities about get off and killing my leg. and then it was just, you know, everybody just broke out laughing. It was just funny as hell. Well, then we had to go home because we had too much noise, and we had to go back. And,
right, because now your position was completely revealed.
Yeah.
So you had to did you, in that situation, have to basically get out of there fast?
No, we just called in and said the mission's over. It's
okay.
You know, it's
but I get that you guys did laugh about that.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. And that's not bad. We went back and told me what happened. I said, well, we know what happened. You know, and when you're in that type of situation, unless you got a screwed up CO or something, it's okay. And, you know, if you find somebody that's bad, it's really not doing it. You know, the word's going to get out, and you're going to send them back. And this business about drugs, and this movie they did that, I can't think of the guy's name that did the movie. It was so famous about Vietnam.
Apocalypse Now?
No, the other one. Platoon.
Platoon?
Yeah, and he did all that stuff about the drugs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It made it look like we were on the drugs. I tell you, if anybody's on drugs, everybody wants him out. Because if he's walking point, if he's walking flank, and he's out in La La Land,
right?
You know, your flank's going to be useless, you know. So
it's worse than useless bones, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you know, somebody could walk right through him, and he'd say, "Hi, how you doing, pal? They're right over there."
Right.
And then, so what you do, you get rid of him. You tell your sergeant, you know, we'll go with it, and we get him out, and we send him back to wherever. And in most cases, he ended up back in Okinawa, and then back home. So
now back in Okinawa, would there be some kind of judicial proceeding or something against
them? They'd get the word, be tagged. In most cases, they'd be shipped right out of the Marine Corps. They'd be sent back to the States with probably a general discharge or a BCD and kicked out of the Marine Corps.
So just on this topic for a moment, Gary, did you know of guys who were, even when they were, let's say they're not walking point, they're not on a patrol, they're on downtime or rest time or whatever, that had access to, I don't know, marijuana or something?
No. And
you just didn't see any of that?
No, and I'll tell you something else we did. I don't know about the Army.
Yeah.
When we were off duty,
uh-huh,
we kept everybody busy. And in most cases, you didn't have to keep them busy. They knew what to keep busy. You know, you always, if you ran out of something to do, you cleaned your rifle.
Right.
And
that was taught, right? From the time they came into the Marines.
Yeah. And it was hot. And so a lot of cases, you'd go back and you take your shirt off and you put it up there to dry and you put on a dry one. Because if you went to bed that night in the rack that night with that wet shirt and the temperature dropped 20 degrees,
mm-hmm,
you freeze your rear end off. So you'd put the one up there to dry, you change socks, you always change socks, you put them up to dry, if you could, you washed them out, you always washed your shirt out if you could, your underwear too,
mm-hmm,
you know, and just try to keep yourself as clean as possible, and if you had time, you'd wash your hair,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
the things you could do, there's always things you could do, you know, and write letters and do all that other stuff. And we didn't find somebody. You know, yeah, you find them resting, that'd be fine. You know.
Sure. Oh gosh, yeah.
But you know, but not too long. If they were sleeping, leave them alone. Because
I'm sure more times than not, they're exhausted from the heat, all the action that they've been in, and so on.
Then most of the time, and I'm not speaking from a combat veteran here, just a little time I saw,
mm-hmm,
and talking to a lot of my buddies, you know, you spend most of your time doing nothing,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
you're back at the place. And a lot of times you're preparing your hoochings. Now, this is from my other buddies. You spend most of your time, those guys are digging deeper holes all the time, you know.
And the reason for that?
In case you get mortared, you know.
You need some kind of bunker, yeah.
Yeah, it's always good to be about another 8 inches down, you know.
Right, so...
Two more sea bags on top.
So you can't think of anything else, get a shovel and get going.
Yeah, I mean, just do something to, you know, because after a while, you can get bored doing nothing. And I do the same thing. I get bored and have nothing to do. I wouldn't do anything to do for set up for the next 2 or 3 days. You're not going to be doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, hell, I just try to find some more timber or land around, and I'd spend time with my binoculars looking out around the countryside, see if I could pick up some kind of movement. And you see that all the time. You see somewhere out the valley out there, you'd see all of a sudden you see some mortar rounds land.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere somebody else saw somebody moving.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of time it was just a harassment fire. You'd call in a harassment fire out there to be landing just to let them know that you were there.
Now, it's pretty clear that there was that the Happy Valley was not a free fire zone. I mean, you guys had to work with the civilians who were there. But was part of the mission to try to get friendly civilians out of there? It sounds like it.
Yeah.
Relocating them to other villages.
Yeah.
Okay. But could you pretty much fire if you saw some movement? Could you pretty much call in fire or at least let people know?
Yeah, it was a free fire zone.
It was?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask if I can about, you mentioned that you had to keep yourself clean, and you had to keep, you know, try to stay in dry clothing as much as possible. Guys must have been getting sick, though. And I'm not talking about combat. I'm not talking about injuries right now. I'm just talking about, you know, feeling sick, getting a virus, getting, you know, stung. I don't, you know, all the different things that could happen. Was there a sick call? Did you guys have access to treatment for that kind of stuff?
You had your corpsman.
And what could he do for you? I don't know. Let's say if you had a really upset stomach or something like that.
He'd have pills there for you.
Okay.
I know that. And if you were bad enough, you know, the CO would leave the call up to the corpsman.
Okay.
So the corpsman, he'd go to the CO and say, this guy's sick. He needs to go back to, you know.
Right.
Or he'd say he just needs 2 days rest.
Okay, you know, so so you relied on the corpsman for that.
Yeah, the corpsman's the kind of, he was the doc.
Yeah.
I tell you what else he carried that.
Sure.
I used one time, and that was, what do you call it? Pills.
The malaria pills?
No, the pills you use when your bottom's all stuffed up.
Ex-lax? That kind of stuff?
Yeah, stuff you stick up your rear end.
Oh, yeah, the suppository things?
Yeah, he carried those. He had a bunch of those.
Uh-huh.
And he could always tell. He used the new guys to come back, and he'd walk around, and he'd ask them, when's the last time, you'd made a number two?
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, it's been 2 or 3 days. And he says, how does your bottom feel? And I said, well, you know, my bottom's kind of hurt when I sit down, and it's because your rear end from fear tightens up, you know, it just tightens up, and
right.
So after two or three days, you know, you're pretty well stocked up, so
yep.
he'd say, you go take one of these now, you know, and relieve yourself, so There's a term, I forgot the term you use that, you know, for that, I always like to take my memory is so bad.
You're doing fine, Gary.
There's a term that we use that when things are bad, anyway, it's not a good term to use.
If you remember it, let me know, because this is what life was like for you guys. This is what we need to make sure that is not lost. I mean, this isn't written down anywhere. This isn't in the documents. And that's, you know, why we gotta get you to remember as much as you can about it. Let me ask another thing, if you don't mind, about the medical situation. Did you ever have an experience where one of or more of your guys had to be medevaced out?
Yeah.
Can you tell somebody who doesn't know what that was like, what happened in your situation? What was the degree of, what were the circumstances under which you had to call in a medical evacuation?
Well, we had two guys that, you know, the corpsman would tell you, you know, it's medevac time.
Yep.
And he would tell you, he would tell you the number,
mm-hmm.
and then he would also tell you the seriousness of it, because the medevac people would pick you up, but it also would they need to know the seriousness of the wounds.
Right, how bad it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Which ones we go pick up?
Yep.
You know, and we got two critical over here at A,
mm-hmm.
and then we go over the other place. We got two guys shot in the arm, and they're in good condition. Well, which one?
Yes, right. They had to make a choice.
And also, what the enemy condition is? Is it a hot Z,
mm-hmm.
LZ, or
mm-hmm.
you know, or is it about to be?
Mm-hmm.
You better come get it now, or they're closing in. And so, generally, it'd be a Huey come in, and those guys would come in, and you had to give them the direction to come in from where it was safe, and where they wouldn't less chance of being fired upon.
Were you responsible for that communication, for making those decisions?
Yeah.
Okay.
And or you'd go to somebody, you go to your gunny or somebody's out in the area, or, you know, tell them which way is the best, and somebody would know.
Right.
And then you'd send somebody that done it for it. You'd send them out there as they were coming in, and you'd help them land. You
mm-hmm.
know. Just,
how would you help them land?
Well, you just like see them at the airport. You know, he'd put his arms out. You know, telling them come forward. You know, and
mm-hmm.
and
making sure that he's not going to hit trees
right.
or anything.
Drift left or drift right, and then
sure.
And by the time he's ready to land, he'd spread his arm out to left and right, and then they would settle down.
Yep.
And then that would be it. And some kinds, and then a lot of times we would drop smoke, tell them if it's where we are, and tell them what color smoke it would be. You know, Charlie used to get real sight. I'd never had this happen, but Charlie, in a lot of cases, got wise. You know, you say, where are you? So, well, I'm going to drop the green smoke. And Charlie might be on your frequency, so about that time he threw out green smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we learned to do is that you say, I will pop smoke out to you. And then he would, the pilot would say, I see your green smoke. And he'd say, that's affirmative. He would identify your smoke.
Rather than you telling him in advance.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
uh-huh.
So then he would come in, and we'd already have him, Doc had him ready, and we'd put him aboard. And if the most cases, you know, morphine was almost always given.
Mm-hmm.
And it tickles me that, you know, these corpsmen would be dealing with. I remember one time a friend of mine said, had a picture he had kept with him all the time. A corpsman and two other guys were fixing this guy up. And they were up to their chest in the creek fixing this guy up, you know. And he lived, you know. And then they put him on an aircraft. And I keep thinking, you know, you go to a doctor's office, you know, you go to get worked on, and, you know, everybody's super clean, you know.
Right.
You think back there, and I go, good grief, you know.
There he is in the mucky river. And
I mean, what's all this, you know?
God.
I remember a guy that was in a creek bed one time.
Yeah.
You know. And they had no gloves or anything.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
How what was his condition, this guy?
This guy here?
Yeah.
He was shot. He was in a limb, if I remember correctly, another one. And the other guy had fallen and broken
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time I had jumped out of a helo. They had taken us somewhere on the other side of the an area and to drop us off.
Yep.
And I jumped out, and my right ankle, I had sprained so many times playing ball, and it's almost gone. And I had stuff on my back, and it was high weeds. And I jumped off, and I turned my right ankle. I mean, I hurt it bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so. I went to the corpsman, and I said, I've hurt this thing, you know. But at the same time, you couldn't go to the CO and say, I've got a twisted ankle. I need some rest, you know.
Right.
There's just certain times you couldn't do it. And so.
What happened?
Well, we took the boot off, and that sucker was just, you know, he didn't have any ice, you know.
Right, right.
So. You just, you know, that was gone, you know. So we finished what are we doing. So when we had time, we just propped it up and taped it up, you know, as tight as I could.
But, of course, you don't know you could have broken something. You didn't know.
He didn't think it was broken because if you got broken, you feel a sharp pain.
Uh-huh.
And this was just a dull pain.
But anybody who's ever done it knows it hurts. It hurts pretty good.
Yeah, it hurts, and it.
Yeah.
But then again, you—I don't know—your mind was on so many other things.
Sure.
It wasn't that, you know, that big a deal. If you're home, around the house doing something, you know, yeah, it hurts worse for some reason.